All right, everybody. We're back with another episode today, and it is going to be a good one. This track is called Space, and I'll tell you why I chose it in a second. Today's episode, we're going to be talking about how to 10x the chances of your startup success. I have invested and advised over 50 startups over the last decade, and there is no such thing as generic startup advice. Let me kick off the episode with that brutal truth. There is no such thing as generic startup advice. And yet there are some patterns that I have seen with different companies that have gone on to become the mega winners of the ones that I've invested in. Some have gone on to become 3, 4, 8, 12, $14 billion companies. And I will tell you, there is somewhat of a pattern. And it's not really advice, but it is something that can be taken in at the very, very inception of whether you choose to work on an idea or not. So, what is the underlying fundamental piece of wisdom or articulation of a pattern that could help 10x your startup's chances of success? It's one piece of advice that or one phrase that gets tossed around in the soup of 1,000 different phrases that people say within startups. And it's the one that after 12 years of building companies and 8 years of investing in them, the one thing that always comes back is more true than perhaps anything else in that soup of 1,000 different pieces of advice or phrases that creators, founders, investors use, and that is the one thing I tell folks that will increase their chances of success more than anything else. It is to fix a problem you yourself have. We'll get into why this is such important advice, or really it's barely advice because it's not you're already riding the bike and it's advice on how to ride the bike. It's actually like advice before you even get on the bike to choose this bike, that bike, this scooter, to choose the rollerblades. It's the very inception of whether you choose to take one path or another. And it comes back to this phrase, to focus on a problem that you yourself has. So why is that so important? Y Combinator would say this, and Paul Graham says this, founder of Y Combinator. And I remember when a company was in our batch, this was 2012, and one of the three founders left the company, and it was kind of imploding in the middle of Y Combinator. And the advice that they were given was a really interesting conversation. We were in a group discussion, and the founders were chatting with the group partner, Paul Buchheit, trying to figure out what they should do. And Paul said, "What problems are you facing?" And they went through, "Well, our startup just blew up. I'm here on a visa," and he's like, "No. What problems were you facing as founders? List out the problems that you yourselves had as founders and come back next week with a list of 15 to 20 problems that you yourselves had as founders with this previous slight kind of comma or slash current company that is imploding. Basically outline 15 to 20 problems that you bumped into once you decided to build that startup. So they came back the next week and they had this list of 15 to 20 problems. And then he said, okay, of those, which were the most painful and the ones you ended up building solutions for internally? And then they listed off, I think it was like two or three that fell in that bucket that qualified. And then he said, okay, your next startup could be one of those three. It's a problem you yourself have had, you know all about it, and you already started to work on a solution for that problem. That company ended up raising a Series A around that business, ended up building a business around those problems. And it was one of the coolest experiences to see a company that was in dire straits go into almost smoothly, flawlessly go into the next software business that they would end up building. And I thought about that that experience of watching that in this group dynamic. I've thought about that a number of times. And I've thought about that advice. Build a startup or build a company around a problem that you yourself has had. And you have had. And it is a... there's so much wisdom packed in there. I have friends of mine that know nothing about software development and startups come to me and want to build XYZ startup. A friend of mine said that his, I remember this, when I was about 24, two friends of mine, but one friend of mine shot me a note and said, hey, can we chat? I was just starting out with one of my companies. He said, I want to build a social network for pets. My girlfriend loves her dog, is obsessed with it, and it follows all of these accounts on Instagram around similar dogs. And she wishes there was a social network just for pets, and I know through my mom, blah, blah, blah. There was all these reasons of why this person really wanted to start a company around social network for pets. No doubt was probably informed by Instagram selling for $1 billion about a year prior. But the person worked in real estate and it wanted to build a software company. And I was like, I said, that would be like me walking into a building and saying, man, I love buildings. And if I like buildings, maybe I should build a building. They seem lucrative. And if I'm going to build a building, let's really go big with this. Let's build a massive building. And it would be like me telling my friend, I really like buildings. I think there should be a building over here that does X, Y, or Z in this part of town. I think I should go do this. And my friend asking me point blank, are you a general contractor? Are you an architect? Have you ever built a building before? That is what it's like when you start a software company and you have no idea how to build software. It is like liking apps or liking buildings and saying, yeah, let's build a 70-story building. It can't be that hard. I've been in them before and thousands, countless people have done it before. So why can't I do it? My friend didn't have that problem of even wanting a social network for pets, but had chosen that problem for who knows what reasons, but likely driven by some result that they thought, okay, this would be a lucrative business to start. Instead of, this is a problem that I have, and this is a problem that I understand. The reason that you want to focus on an area where it is a problem you yourself have is because that means that you have, if you have the problem, if you've struggled with that problem for a while, then you have untold knowledge. You have countless hours of familiarity around that problem that you're probably taking for granted. And the single most important area of expertise in building a solution, in my view, is the expertise of really knowing the problem. A couple things actually come with building a solution for a problem you yourself have. That's that familiarity, extreme familiarity with the actual problem, which is the foundation for then knowing what to build for the solution. You're also going to know a lot about the different solutions out there. So you're going to know the whole universe of potential solutions, why they're good, why they're not good, why they don't really fit for you. You're also going to really know a lot about the space. Let's say the problem you have is you are making extra money by renting out your couch or your extra bedroom for design conferences that come to your city. This is the founding story of Airbnb. And you've done it a few weekends in a row. You've made more money doing that than you made in freelancing gigs in several months prior. And you realize, man, I need this extra income. These conferences happen all around the country and all around the world. We could just go conference to conference, city to city, find people to sign up and take a split of the income that these people earn. But also, they studied this problem before Airbnb really took off for 2 years. So not only did they have the problem and they had their own solution by doing it themselves, but they also continued to study the problem for an extra 2 years. And they also knew that there weren't any solutions out there to help them with what they were trying to do, make extra income with visitors that were coming to, in that case, San Francisco, pretty often for all kinds of different conferences beyond the initial design conference. But by focusing on a problem that you yourself know well, then you're going to have that familiarity with the problem, which is absolutely key. If you don't really know the problem, then how the hell can you expect your solution to really solve the other people with that problem? The other thing that comes with you solving your own problem is you're going to know the other customers. I'd say coming up with a solution is about 50% what's in you and your team's heads and 50% what's in the heads of your first initial customers. That point of being able to have conversations with your first customers, feedback from your first customers, that's going to be just as valuable as any stroke of brilliance you think that you have around that solution. It's another reason that Y Combinator is famous for saying launch early. You launch early because if you don't launch early, if you continue to just tinker in, you know, behind closed doors, you're not going to get that invaluable input from the other customers. And if you're solving for a problem you have, let's say you're a graphic designer and you want to build out something like Figma that allows you to collaborate around design files. If you aren't a designer and you're building collaboration software for designers, not only will you not know the problem space that well, but you're also not going to really know who are the first 20 customers I'm going to get to give me feedback, maybe the first 50. What is inherent in solving for a problem that you have is you're likely in a community of people that have a very similar problem. So it comes with the familiarity of the problem. That is an extreme familiarity that's required to build a really valuable solution. It also comes with that network of your first 20, 2,500, 200, maybe the first 5,000 customers because you're a part of that community. So it comes with familiarity of the problem. It also comes with that network of your first customers. The expertise to build out a solution and to know that problem set is the first foundation. The second is those first key customers that give you those insights. Once you start to get going, the next thing is the recruiting, the rest of the team, your first co-founder. Maybe it's two other co-founders. Maybe you are starting to see progress and you need to hire maybe it's a VP of technology. It is your first engineer. Maybe it is a consumer products good company and you need to find someone that can help you with the formulation of a drink, whatever it is. If you are disconnected from that network and it's not a problem that you yourself have, you are maybe on the sidelines and you're like, you know what? I'm going to build a social network for pets. If that isn't your expertise and you yourself don't have that actual problem, then how are you going to be able to find the right engineers that are as passionate about that problem as the first team members need to be? they're probably going to be, each subsequent hire is usually going to be half as passionate as the previous hire that you brought on in an early team. Your first hires are going to be half as passionate as you as the founder. That's how it should be. And you kind of go down the line. If you're not passionate about the space that you're going after, then you're starting from a pretty dangerous point in that continuation for the next team members to join that are maybe even less passionless, or even more passionless. But the other area that comes inherent with you yourself having the problem is you're going to know the space really well. You're going to know the 5, 6, 7 partial solutions that don't really work for your problem. And you're going to be able to navigate the space, the universe in which your problem will exist really well. You're going to know what the initial demographics of your first customers are going to be. You're going to know how to market it. You're going to know how to position it as opposed to all of the other potential solutions in there. You're going to inherently know all of the research that maybe a venture capitalist would put into understanding a space. If it's a problem you yourself have and have dealt with for years, you're going to implicitly know more than any outsider that's trying to do a quick 3-4 month deep dive into a space. That's extremely, extremely valuable. And if you yourself solve a problem that you have and have had and have extreme familiarity with, then you are going to implicitly understand all three of these key areas: the problem, the first customers and recruits to help you build the right solution, and the space in which you're building it. And it all comes into focus when you realize, all right, this is a domain that I know well. This is the limitations of the current solutions, and this is how I could maybe carve out a unique solution for this set of customers that is like me. This doesn't even need to be a venture scale startup. This can be a small 3, 4, 5 person company that you're building out that is an awesome cash flow machine, but you get this massive head start that I don't even think an outsider can ever get by implicitly understanding those things. And the reason I say an outsider can rarely ever get these things, the familiarity of the problem, first customers, the first recruits, and that familiarity of the space and the constellation of partial solutions, because that outsider also won't run into the problem over and over and over again to make sure that the solution is as good as he or she wants. But if you are running into the problem today, well, then the solution that you're building out for that problem you're running into today is only going to get better a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, because ostensibly you're running into that problem again and again and again. And your solution, it's one of the painful parts of creation, is going to be really far from your ideal solution in the beginning. But you're still going to have that problem, and you're still not going to have a solution to that problem, even with your own version and first iteration of that problem, or solution, and you're going to just refine and refine and refine until it does solve the problem you yourself have today. So that is my advice to how to 10x the chances of your startup success. And if the startup stats are right, that it's 5% success rate for startups, then this could give you a chance to where it's 50%. A slight addendum to this would be, focus on where you uniquely can be useful towards this solution. If you don't know how to program, if you don't know how to build software, make sure that if you are trying to build a startup around this problem, that you are bringing the fact that it is your problem. That's going to be huge. But you want to make sure that you're either great at sales or you're great at building software if you're going to start a startup, a venture scale startup. Maybe, and this would be a fork in the road that I've seen a number of times, where let's say you've dealt with mental illness before, and you want to start a company that helps solve or helps bring a solution that you yourself have discovered to others. I'm literally thinking on the fly, but let's say it's a mental health company around gratitude journaling. Because it's worked for you to just rewire neural pathways towards gratitude, and it's helped you get out of a funk. You can make physical journals or you could make gratitude journaling software. Just make sure when you are focusing on potential solutions, they'll utilize a domain expertise that you yourself has, or you have access to those domain experts that you can recruit to join you. Because you could go in totally different directions with that very example I gave. You could build out a company that sells physical journals, or you could find yourself in designing and programming and building out software that is scaling around the world. That might be vastly different and extremely far afield from your domain of expertise. And at the end of the day, maybe you are building a solution that you yourself wish existed, or maybe you're accidentally tiptoeing or wading into water that is actually just financial engineering and you don't consciously realize it, but you're actually just not just building a solution, but you're thinking, well, I don't know, I saw a tech company go public for $100 billion last month, so maybe it should be a tech company. And building a company for financial engineering reasons versus building a company because it's a solution to a problem you yourself have are very, very different things. And I would argue that that first example of financial engineering is not really related to the larger point that I'm trying to make, which is build a solution for a problem you yourself currently have. All right, so now we're going to get into voicemails. We got some voicemails in the hotline, and the hotline number for Below the Line, you can submit any questions you want, is 424-272-6640, 424-272-6640. So let's get into this this first one here.
Hey, James, this is Sam Sawyer from Austin, Texas. Big fan of the podcast.
Sam, Austin's a great town. Thanks for listening and giving the call.
Just had a question around startups and delegation of tasks. Just curious how you think most startup founders should spend the majority of their time and how they should think about offloading, you know, tasks to team members and things like that. I know a lot of people get in their own way and try to control everything, and I'm just always trying to learn the best way to delegate things and streamline operations. I know you have a lot of experience. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Great question. And thank you again, Sam, for listening. There's two thoughts that come to mind when it comes to this strange amorphous world where you are the founder, you have probably done everything to date, and now you are bringing on other team members and you're trying to figure out, this is also part of it, is trying to figure out when to bring on other team members and how to go from doing everything to delegating. And delegation sounds great. It's essentially you not doing the task. But when you are a founder that has built your identity around this baby of your company, then it can be very hard to not do an important task that is going to ultimately reflect on what you built. People are going to see it and they're going to judge all of your work, maybe based on the impression that they get from someone else's work that isn't you. So it actually is a really hard thing to do. The two things that come to mind, and this, both of these come from a book, a great book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And it's a, love this book. Even the title sums up the synopsis of this concept of what has gotten you to this point might be the very things that keep you from getting to the next milestone that you have. And what got you here of doing everything yourself might be the very thing that curbs the growth and potential of your company, because you are too controlling, too much of a detail-oriented control freak to let others actually blossom as team members. So two things that come to mind. First off is founders in general, especially when they start to bring on their first few employees, a few team members, and this can go for anyone in the C-level, when you're building out a team and you are thinking about 2 years out, 3 years out, 5 years out as the founder, you really should be the person that is thinking 90 days out and beyond more than anyone else. In fact, the ratio should be about 75% of what you're working on and what you're thinking about is 90 days out and beyond. 25% is on today. The next layer beneath you, and this, Sam, I don't know what size company you have, but let's say it's a 15-person startup. The next layer beneath you should be thinking and working on 50-50. 50% of what they're working on is 90 days out, and 50% is on the next 90 days. And then you have the layer beneath that of a 15-person company, and it's the reverse of you. It's 25% thinking about, okay, we have this thing that we know we want to accomplish, or this launch in August, 6 months from now, 7 months from now. So I'm going to think about that, incorporate that into my own roadmap for the next 90 days. But 75% of my time and focus is on the next 90 days. So in that cascade, you can see that as the founder or CEO, you should be spending the majority of your time thinking and planning 90 days out. And that's because if you don't do it, no one else will. And that might be establishing the milestones you want to hit 6 months from now, 5 months from now, before you start to fundraise for your company. Maybe it is establishing the product roadmap for 6 months out, 12 months out. Maybe it is continually thinking about what is that real big opportunity. If it's the very earliest days, maybe it is thinking about that opportunity a few years out. Maybe you actually should be incorporating information in to tweak the vision of where the company could go. And if you're not thinking about that, then no one else really will be in the company, and no one else is in that position to think about those things. So that should help give you some framework on how much you should be doing, and said another way, how much you shouldn't be doing if it has to do with the next 90 days. About 25% of your time should be spent, which is a decent chunk, on things that are important and key for knocking out and completing, you know, milestone-wise for this week, this month, next month. So that's those are important, but not nearly as important as setting up a meeting tomorrow that will be key for a time 3 months from now. You know, setting up that recruiting meeting for that's, you know, is way too early to get this key recruit, but you know that it's key for you to be thinking about that key recruit that you're going to need in 6 months and start the actual hiring process and those initial cups of coffee with the people that you might want to hire. Or learn about the role that you are going to be hiring for, you know, a CTO role, that really starts 6 months before you ever want to fill the seat. So that is one thing that I think about. The other thing that I think about is when it comes to delegation is I remember my general counsel, my company telling me one time that that me being in the weeds with every detail was really taking the oxygen out of the room for people to feel like they can make their own mistakes. And if you take the oxygen out of the room for people to feel like they can't make any mistakes because you're going to come and you know, clip their wings, then that's going to really sabotage their ability to think big, to work big, to be big. Because, you know, with any job, it really takes about a year of that person being in that seat before they flourish. And that year should consist of them bumping into the walls, learning, and becoming the expert in the role that they've been hired to execute. But if you're continually coming in and decreasing, taking the oxygen out of the room or closing in the walls, just inadvertently too, saying, no, let me do it. Just give it to me, I'll do it. Those little things they're really tragic for someone's psyche and developing into a role, because I mean, not only are they tactically not going to learn by bumping into the walls, but they also are going to have this singed in the back of their brain of, man, if this isn't perfect, then it's just going to be taken out of my hands. And then the next time they're given something that they might know right off the bat that they're not an expert in, they're going to say, okay, the chances is going to be taken out of my hands is pretty much 100% because I've never done X, Y, or Z before. So they're going to be really hesitant to even take on that task. And that's just obviously not what you want in a working dynamic. So this GC told me that. And then he also said, you might not get 100% of what you want, by delegating and giving up control, but you will get, but you will likely get 90% for 5% of the work. And I just did the mental math. And whenever I did take on a task, because I just thought, let me just do it, and it would take me 10 hours to knock it out beyond just clipping the wings of the team members around me and not letting them grow and develop. But I also, that's 10 hours, that's a significant amount of time that I could have, in his example, you know, limited down to 30 minutes of being lightly involved and getting 90% of the same results. The math was pretty clear. Once he said that phrase, I thought about it. I've probably thought about that phrase. That was 6-7 years ago. 90% of the results, 5% of the work. If you hire well, and it really should be that, that's it's always stuck with me. But thank you for the call. We're shilling magic here. We're shilling magic. Magic Mind specifically. A 2-ounce shot used by everyone from Silicon Valley founders to artists, Grammy Award-winning musicians, to Navy SEALs. It's 2 ounces of matcha goodness, nootropics, adaptogens, basically everything that gets you into flow state. And it is automatic flow state. Within 15, 20 minutes of taking one of these babies, you feel like you are in a groove and your to-do list just melts away. This is something that I've been working on for 7 years now, and now with a team of five brilliant doctors, medical researchers, that joined 2 years ago to bring the product to market after I was working on it for 5 years just for my own morning ritual. I was diagnosed with a heart condition, and I'll spare you the details, but I'll tell you 6 to 7 cups of coffee a day is not the answer. But 1 cup of coffee with a Magic Mind shot, and the world is your oyster. So go to magicmind.co and buy the world's first productivity shot. It's magicmind.co. Enter promo code BTL for below the line and get a nice little discount for listeners for the show. Magicmind.co. This episode is also brought to you by Tiny Capital. If you've ever thought about selling your online business, it is a nightmare. You have 6-7 months of negotiations. You have all of this back and forth, retrading of terms. You got the new buyer, the company that's buying your company, that then trashes the business you spent years building. If you want to skip all of that, go to tinycapital.com. They have not only built their own businesses, they've also bought some of the best businesses of the last few years that have decided to sell to Tiny Capital instead of going the route that I just talked about, because Tiny has built the dream scenario for acquisition of your online business. They will review your business in 7 days, make an offer in 1 to 2, and they'll close within 30. That is unheard of. When I sold my last business, it was a 6-month trek and painful every step of the way. So I had never heard of anything this smooth and this much of a dream scenario for selling your business. And I ended up looking into it, and some of my friends have sold their businesses to Tiny Capital and raved about the experience, said that everything that that the website says is true, really is a dream scenario. So go check them out, tinycapital.com, if you're interested in seeing if your business might be a fit for them. It's tinycapital.com, and tell them you heard about it on Below the Line. All right, next up we got...
Hey, this is Colin calling in from Denver, Colorado, and
Colin, what's up? Thank you for giving the hotline a shout. And Denver, Mile High City, baby.
I was wondering if you all had any advice for founders that are debating between raising more capital and seeking a larger exit, or, you know, long-term IPO type strategy, versus seeking an earlier exit, and what the differences are between those two paths, why some founders have chosen one versus the other, you know, what the differences and similarities are to the paths in terms of changed lives or future career prospects, or why someone in the past maybe has decided to seek one versus the other. And
Colin, this is a good question, and this is in the realm of life design, and it's very specific to you. You know, there's a word that is never used in Silicon Valley, and my 10 years of living and working within startups, and the word is enough. So you would have to, and enough is as good as a feast, as Alan Watts liked to say. Enough is as good as a feast. So the first part of the answer would be, you would have to just figure out for you, what is enough? And if you exceed that threshold, then maybe you do want to throw in the towel and say, okay, this was great for this chapter. And we exceeded this internal goal, or this goal that I became more and more enchanted with, of this amount being enough, and here's an offer on the table. And that is one thing to consider around life design. The other thing to consider is the nature of companies when they start working. And that is, when they start working, it is really difficult to get them to stop working. It is so much easier to make a company that's worth, let's say it's a $1 billion company, so much easier to turn a $1 billion company into a $2 billion company, or a $10 million company into a $20 million company, than it is to start two separate $1 billion companies. There's very few. There's like 8 individuals that have started multiple $1 billion companies. But there are a couple hundred people that have started companies worth multiple billions. There's, you know, a couple thousand people. And let's say you are a founder of a business that's doing $3 million in profitable cash flow every year. And you are saying to yourself, you know, this is pretty good. We could sell for 5x our cash flow, 10x our cash flow. That'd be $30 million. That would be profitable cash flow. That's very possible. Those multiples would work. And that certainly could check the box of the first thing that I mentioned, life design. But at the same time, that business that's doing $3 million in profit, that is really, really hard. If you are the founder of one of those businesses, then you know how insanely hard it has been to get to that point. All of the hoops you've had to jump through, and all the near-death experiences to get to that point, that's a really hard thing to build. And to double that, you have all of these wins. You have essentially all of those hoops that you've jumped through. You've stacked up, let's say, 17 different things have gone right for you. And if you did sell, if you were attracted to starting a company before, you're likely going to be attracted to starting another company. It just... it's something that once you get a taste for it, there's few other things that you want to do, because it is so intellectually rewarding. It's profound. And if you're on the other side of this, and maybe you're 5 years in and you're exhausted, but you will likely get the bug again, and you'll have to get 17 things to go right again. So maybe the question isn't around what is enough, but the question is, what do you want? And that is a hard question to answer. No one knows what they want. But maybe it is, you know, the pieces of tactical advice that I just gave, but it's also potentially something to where you carve out 2 hours, 3 hours on a Saturday, and you write down what you want by this point in time in your life. That's, you know, 10 years out. Write down what the ideal life would be for you if you were to try to design it, and then work backwards from that. Start with success, what life success, life design success looks like. Work backwards from that to this point in time right now. And maybe it is a question of selling now or selling later, and maybe it's a question of actually saying, you know what? What I really want right now is rest. So why don't I design a way where I can get 30 days of just decompression because I've been going for 5 weeks or 5 years. And in that, if that's the case, that is doable and you'll be a much better founder for it. There's nothing as powerful as perspective. And founders often, I know in my experience, I lacked perspective when I was so in the weeds, neck deep into all of the challenges and thought that I couldn't get away. And that's when I would make my worst decisions versus taking a 2-week vacation, just 2 weeks, which sounds probably unthinkable if you think, you know, you need to unwind 5 years of compression, but 2 weeks away and you actually can get this depth perspective, depth perception of you have all of that visibility of what's going on in, you know, right now on the ground, but you get 2 weeks of being at 30,000 miles away, maybe literally, and you get that second perspective. And that's, you know, all vision requires the depth perception of two eyes. So maybe that's what you would probably, what you could entertain. And then that can tell you how to answer your immediate question. All right. Here we go. Let's see here.
Hey, James, this is Nick from Los Angeles. Love the show and love that you're doing video now.
Thank you for listening, L.A. Loving L.A. We're 7 months in. Last month I would give it 11 out of 10. Today I'd give it a 12 out of 10.
Looks great. I just had a question. It's super cool that you also moved down to Southern California. What made you make the move from Silicon Valley? It seems like you talk a lot about the network effect, and that seems to be really strong in Silicon Valley. So what made you move away from that? Thanks. Bye.
So that's a good question, and it is something that I've answered partially in the podcast, but I've never given the full complete answer of why we moved from SF down to LA and left SF. After 10 years, left 7 months ago. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I do believe in personal network effects. You build out your network. And the better that you do, the more trust, the bigger the network. Those things, that's the network effect of you as an individual. Things that you take on, they can become a little bit easier the more that you build out that trust in that network, and you really need both. But for what I do, investing in technology companies, building companies, and for I think what I plan to do for the next 30 years, which is more of that, you could make the case that Silicon Valley is a place to be because of that personal network effect that we talked about. But there are a few things that I really just felt like it was, and this whole podcast is dedicated to brutal, honest takes on things and the brutal, honest truth of what's really going on beneath the surface. So I'm going to give the real answer. And there was a push and a pull. The push away from San Francisco is, it was a few things and from Silicon Valley in general. And the push away from it, to be honest, one of the things that I really feel strange to say, but I did not feel like it was a very creative environment. I felt like it was, even though you'd think the startup capital of the world would be extremely creative, I think that, one, a lot of the actual creative folks in San Francisco and the Bay Area, they moved down to LA, whether it's, you know, you're a musician or you're a comedian or you're whatever, the art form, graphic designer. A lot of those folks moved down to LA, and even the ones, the really creative folks within the startup realm, the designers, a lot of them were moving down to LA a few years ago for a similar reason. But it's Silicon Valley is just, it's very engineering centric. And engineering-centric minds. I'm not a psychologist. Have no idea if any of this maps to reality or if it was just my perception. But my perception was that, oh man, there's so many people here that the vast majority are just kind of robotic engineering minds that are not even engineering cool products as much as they are wired to engineer financial outcomes. And the engineering mindset is one that, you know, values things over people to begin with. I think that's just like a personality trait of people that are attracted to things and programming. And I was attracted to computers as much as way more than any of my friends. But I also I really always loved personal relationships. And I felt like Silicon Valley over time just became more and more around this engineering culture towards financial ends. And I'm going to build this startup because it has this size of a market and it has this chance to be like Uber or Facebook or Airbnb. And what they're really saying is it had this chance of to be like those companies in terms of a financial outcome. And within Y Combinator, within my networks within Andreessen Horowitz or at Airbnb, it was really the, I feel like it was near the pinnacle or peak of the individuals in that ecosystem, extremely talented individuals. But I saw over the last 10 years, it go from really genuinely wanting to positively impact the world to what is the de-risked way to make a shit ton of money. And that just got further and further removed from my background, started in the nonprofit realm. And so I found myself in a ecosystem that I didn't really jive with. The other thing, and that's tied to this, is the importance placed on relationships. I love connecting with humans. I love connecting with people. I love their stories. I love, if you're listening to this podcast, I love your story, whatever it is. It's just how I'm wired. And when you get into a left brain engineering centric, engineering towards financial outcomes centric ecosystem, then every relationship becomes transactional. And that's really just lame, super lame. And it felt like the relationships were becoming more and more transactional and more around, okay, here's this $10 billion outcome, billion-dollar outcome that I'm going for. And the people around me are tools towards that outcome. And it happens in implicit ways. It happens in unconscious ways. But it's still, whatever the reasons, it happens, and it's at the end of the day, we are what we value. And if the ecosystem values that, then they're going to see you, me, everyone around them as either a means towards getting that, or they're going to size you up as a partial, a vicarious value towards that thing that they ultimately value. And that is bad enough as it is. But the other thing that I'll add in there is Silicon Valley does not have much of a sense of humor. And that is like soul crushing. I think it's Oppenheimer that said humor is the only divine quality that men have. And that is, this is a true story. I had two really funny friends in San Francisco. They're both listeners of the podcast, I think so. You probably know who you are. Two really funny friends, and they both left. This was about a year ago, and I was like, shit, I have no funny friends. And that's an overstatement. I love my friends in San Francisco, but I also am not going to sugarcoat it. There just was not enough appreciation for humor, for comedy, for just joking around. Everything was so serious all the time, and the conversations were so serious all the time. And really, it was like 24 hours a day, even if it was a interpersonal relational dynamic, the dynamic anchored around how can I financially, benefit? And that sucks. That just sucks. That takes the humanity out of that relationship or out of that dynamic. And I think that it's not even like how people are wired. It's how people in a place, in a time are wired. And that's, I think you could take those people out for 90 days, put them with other people surrounded, surround them with people that love to laugh, and maybe they'd get that back. And maybe there are other friends or people in San Francisco or the Valley that identify with us perhaps. And maybe this is changeable, but that's another reason, a push. Another thing is, as an investor, the other third push is that as an investor, at the end of the day, investing is best encapsulated by a phrase of finding misplaced low optimism. And with me investing in companies, it's as much just investing in opportunities in general where there's a misplaced low optimism. And the reason that phrase is important is because if it is properly placed low optimism, then that means that, well, you should have low optimism around, I don't know, this idea that is going to crash and burn. That maybe that's properly placed low optimism around, I don't know, traveling to whatever, Mars. Maybe there should be properly placed low optimism around that. Or there is misplaced low optimism where there's low optimism, but one individual, Elon Musk in this example, has the audacity to say that's actually misplaced low optimism. And here are the reasons why we should have actually higher optimism around this. And so in the same vein, Silicon Valley, the whole world has high optimism around technological innovation coming out of Silicon Valley. There is no low optimism there. It is properly placed high optimism that great innovation will come out of there. And that means that there might be great innovation that comes out of it, but the yield or the return for investments, if there is properly placed low optimism or properly placed high optimism, there is not an easy way to generate investment returns off of that. So even from going from the humanity side of things to the financial side of things, I actually thought as an investor, it just didn't make that much sense to be in a world where all of the yield and investment returns are eaten away by literally investment funds from all over the world injecting capital into Silicon Valley. So there's 100 investors for every there's probably 200 to 300 investors for every great idea, and you really want to be one of the 3 or 4 earliest investors in a great idea to get the life-changing type of financial returns. So even from the financial perspective, from my perspective as an investor, I didn't think it actually made sense. And so I wanted to go where there was, and this gets me to the pull towards Los Angeles. And I think this is the case for many cities around the world. This could be the case for Berlin. This could be the case for Austin. This could be the case for Miami. I will also say 4 out of my 6 portfolio companies in New York all moved to LA within about a 9-month span, 4 out of 6. So I think LA has captured a lot of the folks, creative founders from New York that have been looking for somewhere else. And God, the contrast of LA to living in New York is, it's hard to, especially as we sit here in the beginning of 2021, in January, it's COVID's everywhere, but palm trees aren't. And 71 degree weather is not everywhere. So that was an interesting trend to see a lot of creative people move down to LA. But the pull towards LA was, there was the push for those 3 reasons I mentioned from SF. There was the pull, and there's the low, I think, misplaced low optimism around LA. Within Silicon Valley, everyone that I know, I think conventionally felt like and feels like SF and the Bay Area is where great companies will be built for the foreseeable future. the best companies. And if not the best companies, then the highest concentration of the best companies. And I think that LA is actually a place where I think it is actually 5 years from now going to become the creative capital of the world. And you obviously already have that with certain industries, but I think it'll include the startup industry as well, the technology industry as well within 5 years. And there are a few reasons for that, but I'll tell you a story from 2012. And Nick, I apologize for this long answer to your question, but the truth is, I never actually gave all of the reasons before. And so might as well do it now. So in 2012, we had just moved to Y Combinator and moved to Palo Alto to join YC and end of 2011, beginning of 2012. And I just thought it was a foregone conclusion we would build our company in Palo Alto because the Social Network movie focused on Palo Alto. That's what I knew coming from Texas. I just thought that's the mecca of startups. And within a 3-month span of YC, the program lasts about 12 weeks, and it had gone from the beginning of YC being like, yeah, all startups are in, if you're doing it seriously, you're down in the South Bay, in Palo Alto, Mountain View, to 3 months later, if you're a cool new startup, you're moving up to San Francisco. And then 6 months after that, it was even more pronounced. You had Pinterest, Instagram, Stripe, Twitter. You had four really big companies all in San Francisco. And all it took was those four, and then Airbnb, four to five companies that really shifted the whole gravity of where startups were getting built. And I think that is going to happen in LA, maybe in 2 years, maybe in 3 years. But the same gravitational shift of if you're a serious startup, you're going to be in the Bay Area, 2, 3, 4, 5 big name companies. You obviously already have Snapchat. Honey was sold for $4 billion, which is 3 times more than what PayPal was bought for, which started the whole PayPal mafia of investing in different startups. Honey was sold for $4 billion a few months ago. That's going to lead to a lot of liquidity, ironically, by PayPal. It's going to lead to a lot of liquidity of investment that's going to go back into the startup ecosystem here. And a handful of other little trends like that, that I think is going to result. You have SpaceX. I think Tesla will eventually move their HQ down here, but could be wrong on that. But I think it's only a matter of about 2 years before you have 4 to 5 examples of this next generation of startups being down here, coupled with other founders that I know. When I would see founders that moved down here and I would just casually see on Instagram how insane the weather was, or just 30% cheaper, so you'd have bigger space, bigger, you have a house instead of a loft in San Francisco. It's not a whole lot cheaper, but it is cheaper and a whole lot warmer. And then you also have this cultural element that, I remember looking at friends' Instagrams, and they were going to concerts, experiences on the beach. They were going to art shows, and they were going to stand-up comedy. They're going to the Comedy Store, and which is a really famous stand-up comedy joint here in LA. And it just felt like, God, that's a richer creative experience. And I think the more that founders see that, and they see their friends doing it, they're instead of 3 degrees removed from this place and 1 degree removed, and they text their friend, like I am getting texts constantly, hey, what's it like down there? Hey, I think I'm going to get an Airbnb in Venice and try it out. I just think that is going to be a snowball that continues towards that 2 years from now, 4 or 5 of these behemoths in the making being based down here in LA, and the gravitational pull for, I think, all the reasons I was pushed away from SF and pulled down here starts to take shape. Some of the other reasons are just, I've said this on the podcast before, but palm trees are native down here. So I could talk about all the other different pulls to LA, but I'll leave it at that. The palm trees are native. And there are a few palm trees in SF, but like palm trees around the country. You know, they're planted there, and the palm trees here, I can look out the window and look at about 12 different palm trees, and they're native. It's a really unique place that that has so much going on for it creatively, within the startup ecosystem. I think within the I think the creative capital of the U.S. is shifting over here from New York as well, and so who knows what that looks like in a year or two, but that's going to add to it. And at the end of the day, it's pretty nice living somewhere where palm trees are native. So there you go, Nick. That's why I moved down to LA. Well, listeners, thanks for checking in on this episode, and hit the subscribe button or subscribe on your favorite podcast app if you are digging what we're laying down here with Below the Line. The hotline number is 424-272-6640, 424-272-6640. Call and leave a voicemail, and we'll try to get to it in a future episode. This has been another episode of Below the Line. Until next time.